All right. Well, thank you for the invitation to come here and share this with you. I'm going to be presenting a project that I got involved in when I first arrived to my new institution. I did MediVaps. That was 5 years ago. This is a medical research institute attached to a hospital. I come from physics and computational modeling, so it was a bit of a shock getting there. I started talking to my colleagues, and there was one person that I could sort of relate to and start working my way within the new field there. And this was Paco Artigas here. And he is a pharmacologist who looks at, in rats, he studies how the prefrontal cortex responds to various pharmacological manipulations with electrophysiology, with several different techniques. At the time, he was talking to me about, essentially about serotonin and how serotonin receptors are enriched in the prefrontal cortex and what sort of effects he would expect that this would have in normal prefrontal function. Let me show you just some figures of his work. So what he was doing in this series of experiments was to stimulate in the dorsal raphe nucleus, that's where serotonergic neurons reside, that project the prefrontal cortex and other cortical areas. This is a very diffuse projection from this. But these fibers that come from the dorsal raphe nucleus are very efficient in changing activity in the prefrontal cortex. So here we have prefrontal activity when these dorsal raphe nuclei are being stimulated at time zero. And what we see is that spontaneous activity gets suddenly depressed, suppressed, as a result of these inputs coming from the dorsal raphe. So this is a potent pathway that comes from these serotonergic neurons. They have worked out the pharmacology. They know that specific compounds that block serotonin 1A receptors are get rid of this suppression. So serotonin 1A receptors should be largely responsible for this depression of activity as a result of dorsal raphe stimulation. On the other hand, in some of these cortical responses to dorsal raphe stimulus, what you see is an excitation, and that is blocked by serotonin 2A antagonist. So that would say that this receptor is responsible for that excitatory action in the prefrontal cortex. So the picture is that these two receptors are there in the prefrontal cortex, and they are doing something in response to typical serotonergic inputs coming from the dorsal raphe nucleus. Okay, so that resonated with what I had been doing before, which is studying one function of the prefrontal cortex, and this is working memory. We've been hearing about it. And this is a very specific paradigm that has been studied extensively. And it's a spatial working memory paradigm in which monkeys are trained, well, monkeys or humans can also do this, and I'll show that later, but this particular slide is for monkeys. Monkeys are trained to fixate in a central cross or a central spot. When they achieve fixation, a peripheral cue is presented in one of eight possible locations. This is a very brief cue. It just comes and goes. Then the monkey has to maintain fixation for another 3 seconds, and this is what we call the delay period. It's the important part of the task. That's what we're interested in, because after that delay goes away, and when that delay expires and the signal is that the fixation cross goes away, the monkey knows that if he makes the saccadic response, he moves the eyes to the location where the cue had first appeared, he's going to get a reward. So the important thing is that through the delay, the monkey has to keep that information about where the cue appeared in mind. Somewhere in the brain, that information has to be residing. And the finding in the 70s and the 80s was that in the prefrontal cortex, you could read that memory of the location in a specific set of neurons of the dorsal prefrontal cortex in the monkey. And here I have an example of one neuron. This would be responses of one given neuron to the eight possible locations. And the locations are randomly presented. Here they are just reordered so that we see them clearly in this histogram. So we see the activity of the cell. In response to this cue presented over here, the neuron had a low firing rate to start with. The cue appears at this point. The activity goes up and stays up for the duration of the delay. Then when the delay ends, this activity is reset. And but this is very interesting. This is what we call persistent activity, activation through the delay when nothing is out there. It's only this internal signal that is being kept. And it's even more interesting because this is really dependent on where the cue is presented. If the cue, instead of at this location, is presented at this other location, the neuron doesn't care. Here, neither. So it's really very selective to where the cue was. It's not only about maintaining in time something interesting. It's a specific feature what is being maintained in this circuit. Now, this neuron, like this 135 degrees, if you move your electrode, you go to another neuron, you're going to find one that likes this one, and so on. So you have a whole network that is there representing this stimulus. So this is data from the 80s. I was involved in modeling this. I'll show you that later. Now, right away soon. But before that, I want to show you just one piece of data analysis that we are involved in, and we are. And I'll just show you just a one way of seeing it that I think is underscoring the relevance of this activity for this task. So what I did is I rescued this data set from Patricia Gomer-Rakic that still had one piece of data that hadn't been analyzed properly, and that is the behavior of response of the monkey. So if you take the behavioral responses of the monkey, and here I have all the end saccade points for this monkey in all the sessions in which he was involved during the recording, what you see is that the end point of the saccade is not very precise, right? So the monkey is pretty good at going where the cue had appeared, but there is a slight imprecision. This had been shown already at that 89 paper. And the other element, the other piece of information that they presented there is that this dispersion around the central point is delay dependent. So it's not only about motor problems. It's something that has to do with memory. Okay, so we have this data. It has never been related directly to the neural data. And I thought it was worth a try. And I did, and amazingly, it comes out. So let me show you one example. Let me show you one way in which we can relate neural data to imprecisions in the saccade endpoint. Say we have now a single session, and a session means that I was the experimenter was recording the same neuron through these behavioral trials, right? So these are a single session, means that the monkeys are always doing the same thing, but the experimenter knows now it's all the same neuron. Okay, we have these 80 trials in which the recorder, the experimenter was recording the same neuron, and they are the 8 cues have been presented. And now what I do is I split those 10 trials per cue. I take 5 and 5, taking the median of the response. Say red is the more clockwise. The monkey was slightly more clockwise on the red trials relative to the blue trials, but very slight behavioral difference, right? And now what I compute on those trials, now I go to the neural data for those trials. And now I compute the tuning of those neurons in those two separate sets of trials. And what I do is I do the tuning curves, and I have a fit. I fit the tuning curves to the Gaussian function. I take the center, and that should be like a possible, the coding that we think could be going on in this area, right? So these two curves would be representing at that point this neuron is showing, and I get a tuning bias, which is the difference between those two centers of mass of the tuning curves. Now I have that for each neuron and for each time point. I do that over the course of the trial at different time points, and what you see is that this bias is about zero all the time through the task. This cue presentation, now here comes delay, here comes a response. It's all the time zero. There's no difference between the two sets of trials at the neural level, except right at the end of the delay, suddenly there is a bias in the neurons are predicting the slight inaccuracies in what the monkey is going to do. Right? So I think this is really showing that we have to take this activity seriously. Really, in this activity, there is some information about what the monkey is going to be doing at the very fine behavioral level. Yes?
That's very nice. Did you also find that when the monkey was more accurate, there were more gamma oscillations?
I don't have LFPs here. And yeah, so this is all. Here?
Yes.
Well, so I have analyzed this in terms of power spectra, and you cannot see at the single neural level oscillations, but yeah, that doesn't mean they're not there. They're very likely to be there. But this data doesn't exist. Oh, sorry. So this is
1 second.
These are 3 seconds, the delay. You wouldn't see them now. Yeah, okay. So this is to say that in that area we have the activity of neurons that I just showed you before is carrying information that the monkey cares about for upcoming behavior. Now, another result from Patricia Goldman-Rokicz's lab was that, well, if you actually apply antipyretically serotonin drugs, and these were drugs specific for serotonin 2A receptors, well, you find that this activity is disrupted, right? So by an analogy here, it looks like serotonin should really affect behavior in working memory. If that neural activity is so much important for behavior, is really determining all the details about upcoming behavior, and it is disrupted this way by a serotonin, then it looks like it serotonin should have an effect. However, when people have looked at how serotonin affects working memory in psychopharmacological studies, results are not consistent. So some people say yes, but here we have a paper, Luciana et al. In 98 said yes, there is a compound that increases serotonin that makes more errors, that makes subjects make more errors. But Luciana et al. 2001 says no. So it's also the pharmacology has changed. They're very different, all these methods, and there's no big effect of serotonin on spatial working memory at this level, or there are conflicting results. So we wanted to think, how could that be? How can we make sense of this difficulty in finding something that at the neural level seems to be should be more clear? So the other piece of information we have is that schizophrenia is also in the middle of this crossroads. Schizophrenia is very much related to working memories, we have heard before. And also schizophrenia is related to serotonin in the sense that antipsychotics that are being used today, many of them are primarily targeting serotonin receptors. And serotonin drugs are being considered now for possible cognitive enhancers in schizophrenia. So there are some ideas out there that would relate, but it's weak. It's not a strong effect. But there are all these links there. So anyway, here is like the motivation that I'm of the work here. So there is a strong convergence of all these elements in prefrontal cortex: schizophrenia, serotonin, spatial working memory. On the side, spatial working memory and schizophrenia is a very well established relationship, and then we have this weak associations across these sides. Okay, the idea was to see how a computational network model in the prefrontal cortex could combine these things and give us some insight about what are possibly the mechanisms and how could we test all these ideas in specific experiments. And that's the goal of the study, is to come up with predictions that can be tested experimentally. So let me go to the model that I developed as a postdoc at Brandeis University in Xiaojin Wang's laboratory. This is a ring model, spiking neurons. Oops, sorry. So we have excitatory neurons, inhibitory neurons disposed on a ring. So we are locating neurons one next to each other in relation to their preference. So a neuron that sits here is going to respond mostly when a cue is presented at 0 degrees in that paradigm that I showed you before. Key to this network is the connectivity. It's important that the connectivity is stronger among neighboring excitatory neurons, is weaker with neurons that are sitting further apart in the network, and then you have inhibition that needs also to be pretty strong here. when you have this architecture, and that's what I showed in that 2000 paper, you can connect it and play with it and find a regime of operation that is useful to reproduce that neural data in the monkey in a working memory type. So let me show you essentially the two states that I'll be interested in. One is the memory state. Here you have time and you have all the network. This would be a ring, so this should you know, connect back to each other, right? So the network is not firing in any particular pattern. You just have spikes in an unpatterned way. Then during the queue period, I externally inject current to a specific set of neurons here around 0 degrees. That would be the stimulation. This is representing this sensory stimulation at 0 degrees. Then I remove that stimulation, and the network by itself is able to maintain this localized activity through a long delay of about 3 seconds. So here is being maintained in the elevated activity of these neurons here in the center of the circuit. So if I were to rely on this network in order to perform the task, I would go back to this. At the end of the delay, that's this is time, so things just go by. When I have to perform, I just have this activity here at the end, and from that activity, I try to decode where the queue had been presented. So I just go there, I get this profile, and I say, well, it's likely to have been there, and I do my, I'll perform the task according to this information. So this would be a successful memory trial, but then the network also needs to be in a situation in which it can maintain a non-pattern structures of activity, and this would be this one. So there's nothing interesting out there. I don't want to make up anything. If there's nothing, I just stay in a non-coding state, in a state that is not encoding any information. And this, so we also want this spontaneous state to be stable, right? And this is the stability at the end of this period. I go there and there's no information. Okay, so now comes in very handy that Ala presented the mean field representations, because now you know exactly what I mean by this. So all these complex spiking network models can be reduced or simplified or abstracted in exactly as Ala was presenting, and you can think of this essentially as one neuron connected to itself, and you can think of it as the FI curve, the neural response curve, and this feedback line, and the intersection of those are the stable points. You have an unstable point, two stable points. One is the spontaneous state, low rates, this one. The other is the memory state, high rates, that one. Right? How far you are to this instability point is the stability of your state. Okay, so this is the network that we had. We already knew for other studies that it's a network that is sensitive. It's sensitive to the properties of the cells that you put in, and we found several ways in which it depended on that, and the excitability is going to change as you introduce different currents and different dynamics in the circuit. So, here comes, well, what does serotonin do in the prefrontal cortex? What do we know about those mechanisms? So we reviewed the mechanisms together with Paco Artigas, and he guided us through the literature, and we found the most relevant mechanisms that have been identified in prefrontal neurons. So essentially, serotonin acts through two receptors, 1A2A, and causes a number of effects, of physiological effects in the neurons over there. So we can essentially conceptualize it this way. So in a very abstracted, simplified way to try to put it in a model, this would be like the essential mechanisms that we identified. Through serotonin 1A, what we have is that there is an increase in a potassium current in pyramidal neurons. So the action of serotonin through the 1A receptor is hyperpolarizing. No, this is going to be a new potassium current that it's not. Wait a minute. Yeah, it's this current here. Yeah, it's not a calcium dependent current. That's what is affected by the 2A receptor. The serotonin 2A receptor has a number of different effects. One is it reduces it excites inhibitory cells by reducing the reversal or the leak current in those cells. in pyramidal cells, it increases a cation current, a non-specific cation current that is calcium dependent, and it does so through possibly the release of intracellular calcium. And another effect it has is it reduces calcium-dependent potassium current. So all these effects of the 2A receptor are excitatory. So we have a competition here between action of serotonin through 1A that's going to be inhibitory, action of serotonin through 2A that's going to be excitatory. So these would be graphically how we put that in into our neurons. And now we have a complex situation. We have all the network with all that dynamics, which now has all these additional dynamics coming from these two competing serotonin receptor types. At the time we didn't know exactly how to go about it. So what we did is, we put each of these cells now has all those mechanisms dependent on serotonin. Once you do that, all the previous function of the network is gone. So it's no longer able to maintain this bond. It's no longer the spontaneous activity might be not stable and so on. So we have to recover that situation. So how we do that? There are lots of different ways, as you can imagine. There are lots of many. We have introduced a lot of new parameters that we didn't have. We already had a lot. Now we have even more. So how to deal with that? What we did is we used a machine help us to find different networks. Just to start an exploration here. Let's see what is out there, what can we learn. We got 20 different instantiation of this network that had that required working memory function. So it had stable spontaneous activity, stable bump activity. When we looked at them, here I'm showing you the 13 parameters that we allowed to vary. And their value relative in the range that we allowed them to take. And what we saw is that the networks were, in terms of parameters, very diverse, very different. Some had a high parameter for this mechanism and low for that mechanism. But that yet they all converged to having the same function, the same activity in response to stimulation. So what we use this set of networks is to check for the generality of what we find when we look at individual networks. But in the end, what we ended up is interpreting everything in terms of the mean field. So this is no longer all that. So this was our first attempt to deal with this complexity. In the end, it seems like it's simpler to look at. So I'll show you. So let me show you just one of those networks, how it behaves. So we have this stable bump here in response to a stimulation here. This would be the activity of the top. And now when we change the level of serotonin in this network, we get the change in firing rate that is suppressive. So the more serotonin you have, the lower the firing rate in the memory state. Phasic serotonin, just to check if we're in agreement with those experiments of dorsal RASA stimulation, has the required properties. Essentially, a pulse of serotonin generates a suppression in the activity of the network, and that is very much what similar to what Paco had seen. So just checking. Yeah.
So are you stimulating effects both of 2A and 1A, or
yeah.
Are you determining what ratio of?
So we just the 20 network.
Exactly, are you doing in your model? I guess that's. Are you upping the GK leak or the GK or?
So I'm introducing all these mechanisms all at once in the cell.
Right, but depends on how much you know, if you up the GK by a factor of 10, but only lower IKCA by a factor of 1/10, then that's going to make a huge difference. So I'm just curious what ratio of effects are you using? Do you see what I'm asking?
So you're asking if serotonin is mostly is only going through this way and not that way.
That's right.
No, in the end, I'll show you. We'll do the different receptors now. So there is some effect on both ways.
Yes.
So it's not like this is overwhelmingly. It's not like that. But as I say, in the 20 networks, you're going to find different things. So, yeah. Yeah.
And so that the brain is looking for that behavior to jump in the combination output. So the color, what's the color mean?
The color is one network. So these guys is the parameters corresponding to the purple network. Just to show that the networks are, it's not that all purples are down, or it's not that we just found one solution. The various solutions we find are different in terms of parameters, not in function parameters. Okay, so now let me show you the stability of this, how does serotonin affect the stability of those states that we're interested in. So we have the spontaneous state, and this would be a stable spontaneous state. This is unstable. So it had to be like this, but you know, some local fluctuations in the network made a memory arise that shouldn't have been there. Then you have here another instability, which is this should have been going on all the time, but in this one particular case, it decays. Another type of instability is the precision of the bump. The bump can drift, can diffuse away. Okay, we want to know how serotonin affects these properties of the network. So we run hundreds of simulations with different random seeds, and now we compute in how many of the simulations we get errors. And what we see is that errors due to this instability occur when we have low serotonin. Errors due to this instability occur when we have high serotonin. And here we don't see really an effect of serotonin on the diffusion of the bump. So this made us think, well, this is, it seems like, yes, in this network, there should be an effect of serotonin on behavior. So why don't we see it? And why don't experiments see this more clearly? So what we then did is to do a behavioral test on the model. So really is now, note that this, what I had before, is really testing these conceptual states that we know are there, but this is nothing you can do with humans. You cannot make humans not do anything, but then know if they report, they have to report something. So let's do a task that can be done on people or monkeys. So this is what the network now does that is really mimicking what you could do with animals. So here is a trial. The trial has a long fixation period. It's this one. Then there is the in all trials, there is a cue. And then at the end of the delay, you have to say where it was. So you have to decode, and that's the decoding is the black thing. And then you see if the black corresponds to the red. If not, that's correct. And this is a correct trial. Now here we have another trial that is incorrect, because by the time you reach the end of the delay, you try to decode here information, but you don't know where to decode because there's no information at this point. So randomly you pick one location and it's going to be likely to be an error trial, and this would be an error trial. And this would be another error trial in which by the end of the delay you go there, you decode the location, and here it's very far from where it actually was, so it's another error trial. So you run hundreds and hundreds of these trials, and the only thing you store, say, to do the behavioral trial is where the cue was and where you decode it. So really like in psychophysics. Now there's another measure that we take out of this that is, I'm going to motivate it later, which is the confidence in the response. So how do we decode this is using a population vector. Population vector is for each neuron, you take the firing rate at the end of the delay, and you use this as a way of the direction that it represents. Now you sum all of them, and the resulting direction is your decoded response. But you have another measure there, that is the length of your vector. That's a measure of confidence. If it's a very long vector, it means you have very good tuning, you have confidence in your response. If it's a long, it's a very small vector, you don't have very good tuning, it's a very low confidence in your response. That way we can separate between two types of trials, low confidence error trials and high confidence error trials. In low confidence error trials, you make an error because you essentially don't have information at the end of the delay. In high confidence error trials, you make an error because you have the wrong information at the end of the delay. And these are conceptually very different types of errors that if you don't do the distinction of confidence, you're not going to see a difference, and you're going to mix up at the behavioral level the results. So let me show you now when we do this. Now we do all this, we run lots of simulations, we get all this behavioral data from our simulations, and now we test, we make a performance test here as we change the level of serotonin. So we have serotonin here, it's pretty good, performance near to one. As we increase serotonin, we get worse. As we reduce serotonin, we get worse. So we get worse behavioral responses no matter what we do with serotonin. Yes? Yeah, serotonin is there. So they include the parameters of serotonin.
So what was trying to figure out then where you were using the impossible working combination of serotonin parameters?
Well, it's not an impossible combination. Any possible combination that gives out this sort of behavior in the network, at the network level. So yeah, that's You're worried that you get this all for all of the networks? Yeah, we can go back to this. But in the end, I'm going to interpret that in terms of the mean field interpretation, right? So really, the issue here is that it's a fine tuning thing. You have to be within a bistable range. So no matter what you do, you're going to go this way or that way, and you're going to fall bad. You're going to get errors this side and that side. And it's pretty much irrespective of whether it's serotonin or it's acetylcholine, whatever it is that changes the properties of those cells are going to give you something like this. So it's very much dependent on the structure of the circuit that you are asking in order to get this, which is this bistability, that what Ala was telling us, that WEE had to be strong enough, so you had to move. You want to be in that regime, and that is the strongest constraint. And when you constrain to be there, whatever you change, you're going to move out of the range. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the related question, maybe to clarify that, you're saying of these 20 networks, as long as they satisfy the bistability, then they respond to serotonin in the same way.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not like, stuff like deep learning, but they make the network parameters that all work, and they respond to their modulation.
Right. Okay, so what we get is this U-curve for performance as you change serotonin. And that's what we think could explain this difficulty in finding this, because people oftentimes compare suppressing serotonin to increasing serotonin. If you compare this to this, there's no difference. So there are some studies that do tryptophan depletion and compare that to SSRIs, and that would be really comparing these 2 points. Right, so that could be a way in which you get a zero, you get no signal here, and then if you compare these two guys and you get signal, and you start getting in the literature lots of different things. So how can we tell apart this thing? So, well, here comes the confidence classification. If we classify based on confidence, then the two sides are, the errors committed at the two sides of the curve are really of different origin, are really different in terms in their nature. So as we change serotonin, now we look at the black curve, the low confidence error trials go up. So you get more low confidence error responses, and that's monotonous. And the reverse goes when you look at high confidence responses, it's monotonously decreasing. So there's no ambiguity here if you separate based on the confidence of the trial. Now the other thing we can do is to test the receptor separately. So this is, so we can change serotonin only for one receptor, not for the other, and see which one of the receptors is really responsible for this effect here. And what we find in all our networks is that it's essentially the 1A receptor, the one that mimics what serotonin does globally. So the 2A receptor goes the other way because it's excitatory. So here we see these two guys. You see, it's always the one action through the 1A receptor is mimicking what we see when we do the full serotonin thing. So serotonin is really acting mostly through the 1A receptor, and the 2A receptor not so much. This is looking at all the networks, the 20 networks together, so that curve for all the networks, the U curve, and showing, this was to show that really if you were to look at this and do statistics here, you wouldn't see much of an effect if you look at the whole performance, and instead, if you look at the high confidence, low confidence, here you have an effect, and you can get it statistically. But yeah, the networks perform similarly. And now here, this is a bit, so we wanted to get also prediction for the monkey researchers, and there is a possible, so one way is design a paradigm in which monkeys can tell you whether they're confident or not of their response. That's a possibility, like letting them choose after a narrow trial another possible response. That would be a way in which one could also tell apart confident versus non-confident response. But there's this other idea that maybe can be used in existing data, which is if you compute tuning curves based on the Q, so the typical Q tuning curves that one computes, what you get for in the low serotonin condition is this flat. There is no tuning at the end, right? So those are the yeah, I think this is slipped. So this should be the Q tuning. So when you do the Q tuning on these trials, on the high confidence error trials, the high confidence error trials at the end of the delay, the Q is not consistent with the tuning is not consistent with the Q. It's consistent with the response. You have a bump there, but it's not located. It's not centered on the Q location. It's centered on what the monkey is going to do. So if you center on the report on what the monkey says for those error trials, you're going to get a good tuning. But if you center it on where you put the Q, you won't get any good tuning. And the reverse happens here. Here you have some tuning for the Q at the end of if you take the delay period for the if you center on the Q, but there's nothing if you center on the report. So what we predict here is that in those monkey experiments, as you change serotonin or other serotonin, what you're going to see is that the tuning, the relative tuning, when you center on the Q or on the report, is reversed at the two sides of the curve. So what we found is that the main action is through the 5-H, the serotonin 1A receptor, and it corresponds essentially to a change in the mean current into excitatory cells. We tested that by looking at the effective reversal of this whole machinery and the effective conductance of this whole machinery, and it was really an effect of the reversal, not of the conductance, what we have to attribute it to. So this is really like changing the current going into those excitatory neurons. So that can be interpreted here, pretty easy then. If it's just a change in the excitation of the excitatory cell, it corresponds to shifting that neuronal curve from one side to the other, right? So then it's easy to understand that when you are in the low serotonin condition, you have more excitable, because low serotonin means less stimulation of this 1A receptor, less of this potassium current, so it's more excitable. We shift that curve over to the left. When we do that, this stable point down here becomes very close to this unstable point, so that you lose the stability of this point. So you're going to make lots of these errors, the errors in which you make spontaneous memories, because the spontaneous state becomes unstable. On the other end, when we go to the high serotonin condition, it's less excitable. We move that curve to the other end, and now it's this one, the one that becomes unstable. So here you see that no matter what you end up doing, changes are gonna lead you to errors in one side, errors in the other. So if you only look at correct versus errors, you get this U curve. But if you classify by confidence, then you get difference. And the two types of errors are different. Okay, so these are the predictions. I've gone through them. Yeah, there is this inverted U shape, and this could be partly responsible for these conflicting results in the literature. It's important to separate low and high confidence. That can give us more insight into what's going on in those error trials. Then we have this prediction about delay selectivity at the neural level, and it seems like it could be a general mechanism that we found out, or we are defining for the serotonin modulation, but it could very well apply to any other neuromodulator that affects cellular excitability. Now, let me go to this one. 5 minutes? Okay, so this is so the reason why I'm talking about confidence is really because of this paper. So this is a paper by Sohee Park, in which she does exactly that on schizophrenia patients. So she asks her patients do this spatial working memory task, and they report the confidence in their responses. And then she classifies, and what she sees is that schizophrenia patients make more high confidence errors. So the type of errors that they do is specific of one of the kinds that I was telling you about. So this really seems to be relevant for the way schizophrenics make errors in this spatial working memory task. They did fMRI studies, and what they found is that the activation during those false memory trials is very similar to the correct trial activation. So it really seems like the brain is encoding something in those trials and not for the other type of trial. So that led us to think, well, maybe we should think about schizophrenia with these networks too and try to make there some prediction. So the other motivation is that attractor networks have been motivated, studied in the context of schizophrenia by previous people. And here, this is in the context of Hopfield models. And then Edmund will talk tomorrow more about how the type of networks I'm talking about, spiking networks and all this, and the cellular properties relate to schizophrenia symptoms. But now, what about using this regime in this specific condition of spatial working memory? What can we learn there? So here we have from this paper by that I showed you by Sohee Park, that what we have to look at in order to model a psychotic working memory network is this high incidence of false memories. That's what characterizes this network. So how do we get that? We have the two main hypotheses, GABAergic hypothesis, the glutamatergic hypothesis. We can change our networks to incorporate that. This would be a healthy network. In the GABAergic hypothesis, we reduce inhibition. In the glutamatergic hypothesis, we increase excitation, reduce excitation, sorry. And now what we did is, try those manipulations, and we found that high confidence errors could be high in the GABAergic hypothesis. In the glutamatergic hypothesis, naively, we wouldn't get that, so that would not be a proper model of this dysfunction in the working memory circuit. But if we change this glutamatergic modulation specifically in excitation to inhibitory neurons, then we can get the same, right? So it's a matter of tuning that. You can have two networks that are in this regime that we could call psychotic, responding to the two main hypotheses. When we do that, now what we try, we have these psychotic networks that are generated with the mechanisms that people have hypothesized. Now we can use atypical antipsychotics that target serotonin receptors. So we are going to treat those networks with serotonin receptor drugs. And what these atypical antipsychotics are known to do is to agonize the 1A receptor and antagonize the 2A receptor. So we do that manipulation. This is just illustrative, but we can get an improvement of correct trials. So this would be before treatment. So those are the psychotic networks. Now when we treat them, better performance. If we treat them more with a higher dose, we go back down. And that's, again, it's the same story. Right, it's again about recovering. There were lots of high confidence errors. They go away with the normal dose. But then when we treat with an additional dose, we get the other guys go up. So we're again, the interpretation is again the same. We had this, the synaptic imbalance had turned us from this situation to that one over there. So now this guy is unstable. And we can stabilize it with a normal dose by moving the curve to the right. Now these two guys are pretty stable, but if I move it further to the right, suddenly this guy becomes unstable. So because you're always trying to maintain your network in that regime, progressive manipulations eventually take you out from the outside. No. No. Okay, so that's the end. So from this other side, what we predict is that there should be a reduction of false memories due to the treatment of these of schizophrenic cognitive symptoms, but when you increase the dose, then you get impairment of working memory through the other type of errors. So again, you would get this mu-shaped efficacy of serotonergic treatment with dose, and that could explain also why it's hard to make sense of the literature with different doses. And this should be general also. It's not really specific of serotonin. In these circuits, if these circuits really represent what goes on in the prefrontal cortex during this task, this U-shaped behavior should be really general to any other pharmacological treatment that affects cellular excitability, and a way of getting at it is separating confident versus non-confident responses. And just the people that have contributed. Yeah. Thank you.
Hopefully, in my talk, I'm going to connect that with Nancy's and maybe Edmund's. But I think it's really curious. I mean, it's really interesting that the 5-HT2A receptors are the ones that have the site of things like psilocybin and DMT, which is exactly what you'd expect, because those are the ones that are pushing that non-linearity more towards the shifting that threshold up, which is exactly where you want it to be for spontaneous hallucinations and other things.
Right, yeah. So the action through the 2A is precisely the one.
Exactly where it should be the hallucinogens work exactly, I think because of issues like this, they're going to give you those false, they'll give you a lot more false memories, right?
Right. Yeah. This is what. So the agonist of 2A, psilocybin.
And those are exactly where LSD and DMT and.
Yeah, although this is not really representing hallucinations. Here I'm trying to. These are cognitive effects.
No, I know. It's the same sort of being. The same network.
Yeah. Well, that's that one. Yeah. Oh, in the network, if that's typical in the network?
Yeah,
in
the network. And could we see this maybe as an insensitivity to the stimulus itself?
I didn't get the last part.
Could it also be seen, rather than locking in false memories, could it also be seen as maybe an insensitivity to the actual stimulus?
Right. Yeah. So, in the simulations, it typically occurs here. These networks, they are able to resist distraction, and not in all conditions, but in this one they are. So you can change parameters, and you can be in a situation in which any new thing is going to delete what was there before. But this is not the case here. So if in any of these conditions, there's no spontaneous bump before the cue, then the cue will trigger one, and whatever comes up later, it's not going to affect. But you could change that in the. So in that sense, it's also, it's the cue is not effective in overriding this memory here. And if you just increase the current that you inject here, of course you're going to override that. So that, yeah, that's flexible. Yeah.
So I'm very interested in the approach, particularly with respect to the inhibitory. The maintenance of stability of the spontaneous firing rate. So one of the questions I have, and maybe this might come to you with a question in a minute, is if that is related to the positive symptoms, that is instability of the spontaneous firing, then you want to increase inhibition. And one way to do that, if it's really the 1A receptor that's dominating, is to use either increase serotonin in general, or 5-HT1A agonist. And what I'm wondering is, what happens if you give an antidepressant?
benefits of these antidepressant drugs that, well, generally see as, you know, but I, that's not to say that, that you're without a, but how there could be an effect if it's lost in.
Have people measured the actual public symptoms in those trials?
No, that's, I think it's a good point, yeah, because,
you know, that's a specific prediction.
No, but here, I mean, I want to, this is really about a circuit that is doing this spatial working memory test. So this is not about about positive symptoms in the sense that, you know, it's not about hallucinations. This is about testing, you know, doing a task in which you get errors that are, so how this is, say, in temporal cortex or in other areas, you would need to do a different. You know, you wouldn't be constrained in particular by this bistability issue.
Well, just look at your top right diagram there. What happens if you reduce inhibition in that network? Effectively, it's going to jump into a high firing rate of cancer, which is exactly what's happening.
If you reduce inhibition?
Yeah, even before the stimulus comes in. That's good.
If you reduce inhibition here, you stabilize the spontaneous state. No, if you reduce inhibition, no, you jump into,
spontaneously, that's right. And the point is, you could think of that as a computational model of the positive symptom. That's basically one of the things that, you know, that is part of our model. And it's just that you have, I'm just pointing out, it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's similar.
So it could be slightly relevant.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think people, I like Sohee Park, when she talks about this, she doesn't call those positive symptoms. So I think this doesn't, but yeah, in terms of the modeling, it's just generalizing to other tasks and other situations.
So, I mean, just to push that, the high confidence error is a bit like
the in the context of this task. No, it's only Sohee Park that's starting to do that. Well, she has these intuitions. I mean, she's thinking, so she when she explains why she does that is because she says, well, it has to be very different, the underlying neural substrate, when you think is there, than when you just don't know. And
so we'll see other people like, I mean,
Absolutely.
More questions? So let's thank our speaker again.